This is Tracy Swedlow, editor-in-chief of ITVT and the co-producer of the TV Tomorrow Show.
And this is Colin Dixon, who is founder and chief analyst at Endscreen Media. And this is Tea Time.
Tea Time. Welcome to our radio podcast where we talk about TV, technology, and
tea.
Colin, we have a lot of exciting news to discuss coming up. There's a lot of things that are being announced. What have we got on our list?
Well, we have a bunch of stuff, Tracy. So we're going to talk a little bit about Netflix, which of course is hitting it out the park with their results. But we're also going to talk about something that actually there's been some accusations of Netflix algorithms being racist. And we're going to talk about that. Yes. And I think we've got a couple of stories, that you're going to cover, right? You're going to talk about NBC, their new OTT sports app, right?
Yes. Snow Pass. Oh. And we also have a couple of stories for TV of tomorrow type things, such as AR glasses, new AR glasses. That's gotten quite a lot of interest and funding. And there's another interesting story about the emergence of a holodeck. That's a technology that's being supported by Roddenberry Entertainment, the Star Trek family. So let's dive into the Netflix story first, which is Netflix is doing exceptionally well. Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, that they just keep marching on, don't they? It's quite amazing. This quarter just finished, Q3. The company said it added 7 million new subscribers. They basically beat their estimates, beat the street estimates, 1.1 million in the US and 5.9 million in international markets. And this is, listen to this, Tracy. In total, the company is up 5% quarter over quarter and 25% from the same quarter last year. I think I can't think of any other video service that is growing quite as fast as that. Can you?
No. I mean, they seem like they're the star story, really, about growth. And for what I understand, they're up 80% year to date in stocks.
Well, I don't follow the stock, I have to say, and I can honestly say I am not a Netflix stockholder, although I suspect I probably got something in some fund somewhere. But not that I follow it that closely, but I do certainly follow streamer gains, the gains in users. And this really is pretty amazing. And it looks like I got a feeling that Netflix might crack 150 million streamers by year's end. They may fall just a little bit short, but if they keep going on at this pace, Tracy, boy, it's going to be pretty hard to stop them through next year, particularly bearing in mind that they're just ratcheting up the spending on content still.
They're spending $4 billion. Is that what I heard?
Well, it's $8 billion this year. They just took another $2 billion in debt. So I don't know if that means they're going to be spending $10 billion next year or what. You know, there is nobody spending money like Netflix at the moment on content.
And they're also promising another 9 million subscribers in the fourth quarter.
Wow. Well, if they do that, then they will indeed break the 150 million mark, I think. So that would be pretty amazing.
And we're waiting for that, the interactive TV announcement, right? I mean, they already announced it, but the new work they're going to be doing that we covered in the last Tea Time about, interactive TV, Choose Your Own Adventure with the Charlie Brooker shows, the Black Mirror series, right? Okay, so they're innovating, so that'll be exciting.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to seeing that. But you know, the funny thing was, Tracy, I guess I kind of obsess a little bit about what's going on with Netflix, and I always listen in to their quarter end call. And, you know, you look at the numbers and you look at how they're doing and you've got to think, well, there really isn't any realistic competition out there for them at the moment. So they were actually asked about that in the call. And they really sound like they're kind of schizophrenic about the topic of competition. In the Q3 2018 letter to shareholders, They said, we compete for entertainment time with linear TV, YouTube, video gaming, web browsing, social media, DVD and pay-per-view and more. In that competition for screening hours, we lose most of the time, but we win enough to keep growing. And now, basically, this is nonsense. They don't lose most of the time. The only one they lose to is television. I checked the numbers, Tracy. It's crazy. They basically dominate all other video sources that people are watching for better than an hour a day that are subscribers. And you know, there's nothing that's even close to that. Well,
I mean, I think that might be the case now. But, you know, I watch, you know, the kids that come over to my house, you know, to hang out with my daughter. You know, they turn to YouTube right away. She wants to watch Netflix perhaps in the evening, you know, for dinner. YouTube is still a major competitor and uses of their phone. So I think they have a right to be a little concerned about the screen time because the younger audiences are definitely looking elsewhere. They may be making up in subscriptions because that's a constant fee that they're pulling in, whereas turning to YouTube right now is for free, obviously, for most people. You know, I say, let them feel nervous. We'll see more innovation, see better content, perhaps more investment.
Yeah, I guess I was looking at the average numbers and I was looking at view time, not video starts. Perhaps video starts. Yeah, you could be right about YouTube. But, you know, when you talk about view time, it's got to be Netflix. People come and sit and watch for long viewing sessions.
Right.
But, you know, they also say they're winning against the competition, which is kind of funny because they say someday we will see competition for wallet share, but it seems far off. Now,
well, you know what they're not doing. What they're not doing is they're not doing live sports. They're not doing what our next story is about. Or did you want to add something? Because this next story is definitely going to start competing.
Well, I was just going to say again, this is not totally true. I mean, look at what's going on in the market. We're seeing Disney's new service next year. We're going to see a new service from Warner Media next year, which is jam-packed with great content. I have no doubt whatsoever that NBCU, who we're just about to talk to with sports, will pitch something into the market next year as well. This, you know, the market for premium content is getting pretty ferocious. And I got to believe when everybody delivers all their services, Tracy, that yes, there is wallet share. Wallet share will be a problem. Competition for that will be a problem for Netflix. And funnily enough, I asked a group of industry insiders, will all TV channels launch direct-to-consumer services? And, well, what I found was I've got 73%, 75%, three quarters of them think that by 2022, every major TV channel will have launched a DTC service. So they may not be seeing wallet share, a competition for wallet share right now, but to say it seems far off, I think it's 2022. I think it's only 3 years away.
Well, that's a great transition into our next story, which is about a direct-to-consumer offering from NBC. NBC Sports Gold, NBC Digital, is launching OTT offering called SnowPass. And I believe it's going to be running right now. It's starting now, October 2018 through April 2019. And they're offering 700 hours of live and on-demand coverage of seven different Olympic sports, including alpine skiing, Nordic combined, ski jumping, cross-country skiing, freestyle skiing, biathlon, and snowboarding. And there's going to be exclusive content, and it's going to be on every major platform, such as Android, iOS, Amazon Fire TV, Chromecast, Roku, and online. And it's going to cost you $69.99, which I believe is the annual fee. Do you think that's going to erode a little bit, you know, screen time and video starts away from Netflix? What do you think?
I don't know about away from Netflix, Tracy. Where I think it will start to impact is I think it will start to impact mainstream premium sports that you can't buy this way. I've often thought that, you know, it's what's very clear is that traditional premium sports has kind of golden handcuffs on, right? They make so much money through television licensing that it's very difficult for them to walk away from that and start something up that's really, really competitive. Although they are nibbling around the edges, you see that with NFL and with Premier League, by the way. Premier League are doing the same thing in the UK and in the US. So you're seeing that nibbling around the edges. People are into some niche sport, or many people are into a niche sport. And I got to believe that if they can get a lot of that niche sport, that they're going to watch more if they're really interested in it. And they got that time has got to come from somewhere. Now, it could come from Netflix, but I got a feeling it's more likely to come from traditional sports, because that's, you know, it's sort of in the same sphere as traditional sports. But hell, maybe Netflix and traditional sports are going to suffer because of this.
They say it's going to supplement the stuff that they already show. However, there's going to be exclusive live and on-demand coverage. But there are other sports, right, that completely give you a full channel, the tennis channel. I mean, but this is really direct consumer, and there'll be all sorts of interactive applications and things you can do if you're an ardent fan. It'll be interesting to see how this does, if it can pull enough of a subscriber base to make it worthwhile. It may just be used as an experiment in how they can deliver something small. Like NBC has had some difficulty in the past, right, launching direct-to-consumer OTT services. So maybe they're focusing on sports.
Yeah. CISO was a bit of a failure, but you know, that's pretty different, Tracy, because the content that they had in CISO, I mean, from the get-go, just one look at it, you could see that it wasn't going to do well, because, you know, that content, the comedy content they had in CISO, was available in a lot of different places. And, you know, they had very, very little exclusive stuff. I think they had, like, Monty Python was an exclusive, and there was a couple of other things in there, but just not enough to really get people to really take it seriously when they could find that content in other places. Now, this is pretty different, right? If you can tell people who are really into this content that this stuff exists, then boy, I got a feeling that they're probably going to take a serious look. $69.99 for the entire year. Well, they probably spend that on equipment and passes for skiing easily, probably in a weekend. So, you know, I got a feeling it could work out pretty well for them.
You know, while I was sitting here, I realized we actually need to discuss the Netflix character art. I don't think we discussed that. We meant to.
Well, we're going to loop back on that. We can talk about that now if you like. It's kind of an interesting topic. So I remember, I don't know where I heard. I think I heard this at a conference or something. Somebody from Netflix was talking about how they flex the screen art, the cover art for a show based on a consumer's preferences. And so what they're doing here is that they're trying to, they say, optimize the opportunity that people will engage with content. And to do it, you know, say I like Robin Williams or something, and Robin Williams is in a movie, but he doesn't really feature. Well, they'll pick out a scene that Robin Williams is in and use that to promote this movie to me, so that I know that Robin Williams is in there and I'll get in there and I'll watch that. And I think they're using algorithms to forecast which ones are work and which ones don't. Well, this week there was a report in Deadline that some people think Netflix is being racist. And they gave an example. They were talking about a lady called Stacia Brown. She's a writer and creator for the podcast Hope Chest. And she was promoted the movie Like Father by Netflix. And they picked two black characters who were in that movie. But these black characters only appear for like 10 minutes. And they barely have 20 lines between them, she says. And of course, the movie actually stars two white actors, and I'm struggling to remember who it was now. Kristen Bell and Kelsey Grammer, stars of that movie. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she sort of say, "Well, wait a minute, why did Netflix use black people to promote this movie to me?" It's and are they getting racist? And she said she's seen it with other things like Love Actually, Set It Up, The Good Cop, and other movies where they're promoting black actors. Now, it sounds to me like
is she African American?
From her pictures on Facebook, yes, I think she is. No, it's on Twitter. She's her pictures seems to show she's African American. But you know, this is a funny thing that I didn't really think about. When I first heard about this, I thought it sounded kind of cool, but now I'm beginning to think that this is like false advertising, really, isn't it? Because she's been duped into watching a movie like Father that really doesn't have that many black characters. Although maybe she enjoyed the movie as well. I don't know. But they actually gave an example. They were talking to this guy, Ashok Chandra Shekhar, who works for Netflix. And he gave in his example how they would promote Good Will Hunting to two different people. He said that they would use display artwork containing Matt Damon and Minnie Driver to someone who's watched many rom-coms. Mm-hmm. And they'd use Robin Williams, you know, a scene with Robin Williams to promote to somebody that's into comedies. But when you think about it, when you think about Good Will Hunting isn't a rom-com, and it isn't real. Well, I suppose it is a sort of rom-com, but it certainly isn't a comedy. Nobody would call it a comedy. So,
right.
You know, it's like false advertising, isn't it?
I'm sure you have signed away your life once you sign up for a subscription that says you could never sue them if you felt you were being singled out for your race, you know, which would be an interesting investigation. I mean, it's definitely false advertising, but to be honest, they also change their art, it seems like, every week for that show to kind of reinvigorate your interest in that particular piece of content. So I guess unless there was a specific project where somebody researched how many times this image appeared and what their demographics are of the people watching, you know, in a particular community, or just people who are watching it, what their race is, I would have to see those numbers pop up, because as far as I'm concerned, maybe I'm oblivious. I just see a lot of the graphics change and try to attract my attention, but I don't know. It's a very, very good question.
I mean, I see, to be honest, both
and,
sides
and it's very Foucault. I think it's a very Michel Foucault. If anybody's ever read Michel Foucault, you know, how you're categorized, how you're marketed to, how you're, you know, you're communicated to based on your race, but that's true across every spectrum of life.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me like the algorithms they're using to select the cover art, they're just algorithms, right? They're just looking at data, I suspect. And you know, in this lady's Stasia's case, she's obviously watching quite a lot of African American movies, so they automatically assume, she likes black actors. Is that even a racist statement right there? I don't know. But for me, it would pick up probably on the fact that, you know, I watch quite a lot of sci-fi oriented shows, and I like murder mysteries. And so they're probably, you know, and there are certainly some actors and actresses I like.
One thing I'm looking at, I'm scrolling down my Netflix interface here, and pretty much every graphic that I see for any particular movie, and I don't, you know, I have, these are not in my watch list or whatever, every single person that is being presented to me is white, and I'm white, or they're female, and I'm a female. So maybe there is something to be said about that.
Well, maybe while we're talking about the next item, I'll take a quick peek at mine and see what mine does.
Well, I see one or two that are, you know, are African-American woman, but, you know, and I don't know. It's a very important question. And do people click based on those kinds of things? They must know. They don't hand out their data, do they? Okay.
No, they certainly don't.
All right. So why don't we've covered Netflix's numbers, Netflix's character art, NBC Sports' new OTT service, Snow Pass. And then I thought we would turn to another interesting story, a couple of stories. One is about an emergence of maybe some holodeck technology and a new set of AR glasses. I think I'm kind of well, curious about both, but I think I'll talk about the AR glasses first and leave the holodeck second, because that's the real speculative stuff. So the holographic glasses, which I think is an emerging hot area, right? It has been sort of growing and growing since Google Glass, which didn't do very well. But what's interesting is, you know, these new glasses companies that are emerging are focusing on the glasses as the form factor and not so much the computer, which is what Google did and which is why they failed, because they put the computer in front of the glass. So now companies like, it's now called North, or it used to be called Thalmic Labs, a Canadian company, is delivering different glasses, which you can go to a store, get fitted with, and pick up. And these things are going to deliver all kinds of AR content, including weather, news, alerts, and things like this on your glass. I mean, they have raised $120 million from Amazon's Alexa Fund, Intel Capital, and Fidelity Investments Canada. So it's not like they're just sort of like a small company. They've got some cash, you know, to experiment here. And from they actually also dropped a product completely off their list. They were developing, which was an armband gesture and motion guided device to focus entirely on AR glasses. And what's interesting also to me is that Jaunt, which is a cinematic VR company, which really was looking at a lot of success. They were experimenting with 180 cinematic VR, doing all kinds of amazing work, have pivoted towards AR. So, you know, AR and many other stories, AR is emerging as a real phenomenon, an emerging tech offering that I think that people really need to take a close look at for investment, or just a sort of a medium that they might want to have, you know, to own themselves. So the CEO and co-founder, Stephen Lake, says that this is going to be able to connect with various devices. You're going to have a ring called a loop, which I've seen, of course, to control VR experiences, but you'll have a ring that you'll be able to use to control things. You'll have a speaker on the inside of the bands, and a projector, which will project, like a micro projector, which will project on your eyeglass. I mean, it's really going to be pretty amazing. From what I understand, though, you have to go to one of their two brick and mortar showrooms in order to be fitted. That's an interesting sort of turn of the story, because you can't just buy this, you know, and off the, you know, in a store and walk away. You have to go to a store. There's one in Toronto, and there's going to be one in Brooklyn. And they fit you exactly with the size that you're, you know, that you need. And you probably get, you know, there's a certain amount of tracking that goes on here. They know exactly who you are, what you look like. It may be the emerging, a real emerging of a whole new platform that will provide a lot of data to the, to any kind of content vendors, technology vendors. And also, I guess it's might even replace your phone. I think ultimately it's kind of being priced that way, at coming at it about $999 for a pair of these glasses.
So I've been at a couple of conferences, Tracy, where people have actually said that pretty categorically. They've stated it pretty categorically that in 10 years, we really won't be carrying a smartphone. And I got to tell you, I totally agree with that. The fascinating thing for AR for me is that for pretty much everything around us has a digital life as well as a physical life in front of us, right? So, you know, you're standing in front of a building, you're standing talking to somebody, you're watching a movie, you're listening to music. Everything has some sort of digital life attached to it these days. Mm-hmm. And the trouble is that the two things are kind of still relatively separate. And it seems to me that what AR does is it helps us bring together the digital with the physical.
Also, location is very important, where you go, tracking, and yes.
Yeah.
And you know what will be interesting, which they did not mention from my investigation into the story, is eye tracking. I'm definitely very curious about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm looking at the glasses. They look, I don't know if any listeners remember, there was an animatronic show in the 60s and 70s in England called Joe 90. They look kind of like Joe 90 glasses for me. They're a bit clunky, but that certainly they're probably they seem a little bit more, I don't know.
They're not as clunky as Google Glass. Come on.
No. Certainly not. Certainly not that.
Remember the term glass holes? There was a big controversy in San Francisco when Google Glass came out because someone walked into a restaurant bar. People, you know, felt that they were being videotaped. The Google Glass had a light on that showed that it was on, that was working. People felt they were being surveyed. So in this set of glasses from North, you know, you don't have that anymore from what I can tell. There's no light on anymore. We'll all be on at all times.
Right. Apparently that's the case. But anyway, so as I was saying, Tracy, I'm very optimistic for the opportunity for AR. And in fact, I was really expecting Apple to take a leadership role here. I know they're investing in AR, putting AR in the chips that actually go in the phones to allow that to actually happen in hardware rather than software, which is, of course, much more efficient. And I fully expect them to release some sort of glasses for people in the next year or two. Of course, they'll take their time and they'll perfect it. But I really do. I'm very, very optimistic for the future of AR. I think it's to me, it's a lot more interesting than VR because I'm not cut off. That's the problem with VR for me is I'm cut off from the world around me. And this is kind of the reverse of that. It's connecting me to the digital and the physical worlds. It's bringing them both together, which I find kind of exciting.
It reminds me of Marshall McLuhan's, you know, cold media versus hot media. VR is hot media, more sensory overload, more colors, more isolated, as you say. Whereas AR is, you know, graphics sort of lightly covering your glasses. It's passive, it's somewhat, and you know, it's a light touch, and it'll probably be a much more remunerative business down the road for more companies. But VR experiences, I think, may have a bigger impact for the community of people who choose to embrace those. So, for example, another piece of news, which we can't go into right now for time reasons, David Lynch just announced that he is involved in developing a VR experience for Twin Peaks. I am definitely going to do that. I'm going to pay for that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, some storytellers like Laurie Anderson is doing VR. You know, people who are consummate storytellers, people who are exploratory and innovative, they are going to explore that. And they're probably also going to explore AR. Can you imagine AR glasses beyond just delivering you news and technology and who's next to you and this and that, which is all very, you know, interesting stuff, right? But you're going to be able to tell stories directly to the glass. In simple ways. And I know people will take it, will treat that as a new storytelling platform. So I would say virtual reality could be as a, you know, in also embraced by AR, AR companies as well.
Of course, if you can do AR, you can do VR as well. So, you know, there might be times when VR is entirely appropriate. But, you know, we are running a little bit short of time. Tell us about the holodeck. I want to hear more about this. I'm a big Star Trek fan. I've fantasized about having a holodeck. Tell us.
Okay, well, thanks for that. It's been a hot medium at different times throughout the last 20 years, right? Remember those Tupac Shakur holograms that appeared here and there? I just read the other day there's a new hologram for Ronald Reagan. I mean, you can imagine anybody out there who wants someone to reappear, you know, will create a hologram of their family member. But this story is about creating a holodeck, like in the Next Generation Star Trek, series. And this project is going to take a long, you know, time, I think, to develop, but it's being initiated by a company called Lightfield Lab and Otoy, O-T-O-Y. And they're doing a partnership to create a glasses-free experience. That's what we've all wanted for a long time. Because I've been covering VR since the early 90s, I've seen all kinds of experiments that try to deliver glasses-free, VR 3D experiences. So, this is another implementation of that. I believe the companies have, or Lightfield has made a deal with Ari Emanuel's company called Endeavor. He's the CEO, made a deal with Roddenberry to develop the content. And they are going to try to develop actual display and to develop the content as well. So it'll be very exciting to see if they can create that sense of immersion, wraparound, displays, you know, where you can stand in the middle of the room and images will appear in front of you and around you in 3D. I think, like anything, even like Google Glass, you have to say, you know what, that's a great first implementation, but let's keep moving forward, which is why, you know, like that AR company I just discussed, North is focusing on the form factor of the glasses to make sure you're okay with it. In this way, you're going to have to expect the technology is still going to be rudimentary. It's still going to be difficult, but you're going to have to give it a chance over the next 5 to 10 years for it to emerge, to evolve into something that's really exciting. I don't know how many gigapixels will be in how many pixels you'll see per square inch, but it could be extremely exciting.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds really cool. I think it'll get the time, Tracy. This is big enough that people will go with it over a long period of time to see it develop properly. I mean, it's very, very exciting to be able to be completely immersed in some sort of hologram experience without having to wear glasses. And particularly if you can actually interact with the objects that are around you in some sort of realistic fashion, that could be tremendously exciting. And I think, you know, just as we, I mean, if you think about it, think about the evolution of computer games. I don't know about you, but I was playing Pong and Leisure Suit Larry, and some of those early games were pretty basic, I can tell you, you know, very, very blocky and very, very little detail. And look at how far they've come. So I've got a feeling that people will be very happy spending, going up the innovation curve with this technology as it develops. So that's really, really exciting. I mean, did they give any dates, any estimates on trials or anything like that?
I don't see anything. All I see is that they hope it will scale up to a room size. I'm not seeing any actual deadline. You know what? I will find out.
Boy, you know, the technology for this, I have no idea how they're going to make it work. No idea.
You know, since I've been covering VR since the early 90s, you know, people have been trying to create these experiences. I saw all kinds of audio VR experiences where you walk into a room and you move your arms inside the room and the motion sensors were picking up the sound you would create or the music you create. Or, you know, I saw other experiences where they would create, you know, lights that would change according to how you would move in the space, but that's all motion sensing technology. But this is this sort of long dream, right, of creating some kind of holodeck. So I don't think this dream will go away. Somebody will create it at some point. And I think the one thing they did say in this piece of news is that, you know, Roddenberry Entertainment, you know, from the son of Rod, the CEO, Rod Roddenberry, he wants to make Star Trek real. All the technology that was in Star Trek, he wants to make it real. And I say that's fantastic. They have obviously driven quite a lot of the visions of technologies that we have in our hands today, like cell phones, right? Flip phones and screens and talking computers and voice-controlled computers and networked computers, right? So many of those technologies that you saw in Star Trek, the old series, the new series, are coming to fruition today. So I say Star Trek still pushes us forward, still inspires the great scientists and innovators. And I'm excited about that.
Yeah, it certainly does me, although I would say that he should probably read The Physics of Star Trek by Lawrence Krauss before he gets too excited about doing some of this stuff, because some of it, well, you know,
what about
no idea.
International translators? They had, you know, galactic translators on Star Trek. They had, the tricorder. Wasn't there a contest going on by some company down in the South Bay? They're trying to come up with a real tricorder where you can go around and analyze things right away. I know an Israeli company, we're getting off the topic of the holodeck, but I know there's an Israeli company that came up with technology that you hold your phone or something in front of an object and it immediately tells you the chemical makeup of of the object you're looking at, you know, like the, yeah. you know, the different types of materials inside.
Yeah, that would be cool too. I've seen people trying to invent the sonic screwdriver from Doctor Who. So there's lots of inspiration out there, but I think we're probably just about out of time, Tracy.
Oh, when you get me on Star Trek, you know, we
can go on forever. I could keep going for a long time too. It's one of my all-time favorite shows.
You know, we had Lawrence Krauss as our keynote speaker the first year we did TV of Tomorrow show to talk about.
Oh my gosh, you've got to get him back. You've got to get him back.
I'll give him a call.
Fantastic.
Or an email. All right, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Tracy. Great conversation. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
And we didn't even talk about our tea, Tetley tea.
We didn't.
Our tea another time. Thanks so much, everybody. This is Tracy Swedlow. Don't forget to go to TVOT December 6th, tvotshow.com.
And this is Colin Dixon, and we'll see you all again next time.